You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Detect, From Awareness to Action, Driving Multidisciplinary Application of Screening and Disease-Modifying Therapies in Early-Stage T1D. I am joined by Anastasia Albanese O'Neill, who has many well-earned degrees and credentials added to her name, including a PhD in nursing science, an advanced practice registered nurse, a certified pediatric nurse practitioner, and a certified diabetes care and education specialist. Anastasia has devoted over two decades of her professional career towards type 1 diabetes care, research, education, and advocacy when she was in clinical practice and as a faculty member at the University of Florida, and now in her role as Vice President of Medical Affairs at Breakthrough T1D, the organization formerly known as the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. There's a personal catalyst to Anastasia's impressive career and achievements, as she is the proud mom of a daughter living with type 1 diabetes, whose diagnosis in 2002 spurred her transition from a career in marketing in the public sector to return to school and pursue her important work to improve the lives of people with T1D and to find a cure. Anastasia, thank you for joining and welcome to our podcast.
Thank you for having me with you here today.
It's a pleasure. So let's get into it. Given your extensive history and experience with T1D, there's a lot we can discuss about the disease, but we'll kind of focus on the theme of our series and focus the conversation on early stage T1D. So with that in mind, can you start by telling our audience why it's important to screen for T1D, especially before patients start to experience symptoms or even need insulin?
Yes, that's an important question. And I thought I'd start with the what and then describe the why. So screening for the detection of early stage type 1 diabetes isn't as complicated as it sounds. It's done through a simple blood test, which can be capillary or venous. And the goal is to detect islet autoantibodies or proteins in the blood that are specific to type 1 diabetes. And these include insulin autoantibody, glutamic acid decarboxylase autoantibody, much easier to say GAD autoantibody, islet antigen 2 autoantibody, which the nickname is IA2, and then zinc transporter 8, the newest one, which is ZNT8. And these tell us, Mel, that there's an active autoimmune attack underway and that the immune system is destroying the beta cells in the pancreas. And if someone comes back with two confirmed and persistent autoantibodies, their likelihood of progressing to stage 3 type 1 diabetes, when insulin is required, insulin replacement is required, these folks over their lifetime have almost 100% risk for progression to stage 3 type 1 diabetes and requiring insulin. And in general, I would say that children progress more quickly than adults who progress more slowly, but of course, there are always exceptions. You probably noticed I used the word stage 3 type 1 diabetes. So type 1 diabetes is now staged in the clinical guidance, and we actually have diagnosis codes. So for people listening for whom this isn't familiar, stage 1 is when you've got two or more persistent autoantibodies. So we've got autoimmunity, but blood sugars are completely normal and there are no symptoms. And then stage 2 is when you've got autoantibodies and we start to see dysglycemia. And this is that silent destruction of those beta cells in the pancreas is continuing, and that person is losing their ability to maintain glucose levels in the target range. Now, we have been funding screening here at Breakthrough T1D in partnership with the National Institutes of Health and the Helmsley Charitable Trust for 4 decades. And we have some known benefits based on the evidence. And these include, and this first one is important because it impacted my life, the reduction of diabetic ketoacidosis at a stage 3 type 1 diabetes diagnosis. We can get those numbers in the U.S. all the way down from 25 to 50% in the real world out there to 3% or lower. And DKA is a trauma for individuals and families who experience it at diagnosis. We know we can get a smoother transition to that insulin-requiring stage of stage 3 type 1 diabetes. I just met with a family. Their first child was diagnosed in DKA at diagnosis. And through screening, they knew their second child had autoantibodies. That kid's diagnosis or blood glucose at diagnosis was 130 milligrams per deciliter, so close to normal. People can participate in clinical trials if they know that they are in these early stages of type 1 and help us figure out how to protect those insulin producing cells. And then finally, we have a breakthrough therapy, an FDA approved therapy called teplizumab, which has been shown to slow the progression from stage 2 to stage 3 type 1 diabetes by an average of 2.5 years, a median of 2.5 years more precisely. So we now have a therapy approved by the FDA where we can delay that progression. So there are a lot of benefits to being screened.
Indeed, a lot of benefits. And we'll get more into the treatment of early stage T1D in a minute. Let's go back to screening and how healthcare providers can best determine exactly who needs to be screened, where they can direct patients to get screened, and then how in their already busy practices, how can they incorporate screening in their busy practices?
Thank you for that question, Mel. And I think this is really important because how do we operationalize this in the clinical setting? I'm assuming your audience is mostly folks in the United States, so I'm going to focus there. And this may be news to your listeners, but this year in January, the American Diabetes Association, in their standards of care, recommended screening for all family members of people with type 1 diabetes, and they recommend that this be done in the clinical setting. Why do we know that this should be done? Because we've got decades of data from a study called TrialNet. We've got data also from a population study called ASK. And what we know is that if you're a family member, your risk for type 1 diabetes is 15-fold. And that means it's about 1 in 20 people who are family members, first-degree relatives or second-degree relatives of a person with type 1, we expect them to come back with positive autoantibodies. So our clinical guideline societies, our partners in clinical care recommend that it's a reasonable goal to screen all family members. And so I hope that you are offering this in your clinical setting. And we've got a great screening guide that can help you do this on our website at Breakthrough T1D. But it requires a change in your clinical workflow. So I want to identify for the people listening two simple ways to get this done, not just for family members, but frankly, for anybody in the United States who wants to know if they've got type 1 diabetes autoantibodies. These are the TrialNet study. TrialNet will screen family members ages 2 to 45 if you're a first-degree relative. So that's a mom or dad, sister, or brother, or a child of someone with type 1. And they'll also screen secondary relatives, ages 2 to 20. And those are cousins, aunts, uncles, nieces, and nephews. So they can pick up a lot of family members if it's not something you're comfortable doing in your clinical practice. I also want to highlight the ASK study. The ASK study is screening not only for type 1 diabetes, but also celiac disease. And listen carefully, they will screen anyone in the United States, ages 1 to 99, who does not have a diabetes diagnosis. This means family history or no family history, and at no cost to the participant. They'll screen you with a finger prick, a blood sample from a finger prick, or a blood draw. So these are research opportunities for people in your clinical practice. And again, for family members, it's in the standards of care, so you can set up this screening process right there in your own clinical practice according to the standards.
All excellent and valuable information, Anastasia. And then once a patient is screened for T1D, you touched on this a little bit earlier, what are the types of results that can come from screening tests? And what are the next steps based on those results?
That is maybe the most important question you're going to ask during our conversation. And what I would say is screening is just that. It's screening. So the next, and this is true of all screening tests, the mammogram, screening for blood pressure, your blood sugar. What's really important is before you screen the person, make sure you provide education about what you're doing, right? So they know what type of screening they're participating in. And second, and equally important, is emphasize before you do that screening test that you're going to need to do confirmatory testing. This is a screen. And so we want, before we create a plan of care or make medical decisions, we want to confirm that initial screening test. So make sure that you have a plan in place to provide pre-screen education and, importantly, confirmatory testing. Now, you're going to get back a variety of results. And what you need to have in place is a plan for referral if those autoantibodies come back positive, or be familiar with the monitoring guidance for individuals with even a single confirmed positive autoantibody. What if you don't have the confidence to do that confirmatory testing in your clinical site? Well, there are some options for you. I'm going to mention some familiar names. So TrialNet will do free confirmatory testing for anybody ages 2 to 45. So if you do the initial screen in your clinical setting and you get even a single, just one of those four autoantibodies I mentioned, they will do the confirmatory testing. That is for ages 2 to 45. So remember I mentioned the ASK program. They will do it for ages 1 to 99. So they'll pick up everybody else. So you can do free confirmatory testing through a research pathway, or you can do it clinically. You are looking for any detected autoantibodies. That means that autoimmune process is present and you need to monitor that individual over time. And there's different guidance for very young children who sometimes, especially under the age of 3, progress very quickly, even with a single autoantibody, to older folks who progress, as I've noted, more slowly. I want to encourage everybody, and it's really exciting that we have this available, to review the international monitoring guidance, which was published last year. It was published in the top 2 diabetes journals in Europe and in the United States. And I am proud to say it remains the number 1 downloaded article in Europe, period, over the past year. So you can see what a clinical need there was for this document. I'm a nurse practitioner. I would have been nervous to prescribe screening if I didn't know what to do with the results. And this document will walk you through, based on age and based on the number of autoantibodies, exactly how to follow that person so they can realize the benefits of screening. This article is open access. We've summarized it down to 2 pages on our website. And this gives you a clear plan of care for individuals who are single autoantibody positive, multiple autoantibody positive, and also advice on staging them to figure out if they're in stage 1, 2, or 3 of type 1 diabetes.
Again, all valuable information. We'll be sure to link those articles, both from the Breakthrough T1D website, the summary, and the original article for our listeners to access after the podcast as well. Let's say you have a patient who's been confirmed to have tested positive for 2 autoantibodies and is in stage 2. So there's some dysglycemia going on. What are the options for that particular patient in stage 2 T1D?
So this is part of the type 1 diabetes care paradigm that may be new information for people out there listening. We had the approval of a therapy called teplizumab in November of 2022. Teplizumab is an anti-CD3 monoclonal antibody. And what this drug can do in stage 2 type 1 diabetes, so again, 2 or more positive autoantibodies and dysglycemia, as you noted, Mel, can delay the progression to stage 3 type 1 diabetes. This breakthrough was so important that it prompted the change in the name of a chapter in the standards of care. Chapter 3 of the ADA standards of care used to be called the delay or prevention of type 2 diabetes, because that's the only type of diabetes we could delay. Now that chapter is called delay or prevention of diabetes, because we can now delay type 1 diabetes in people who respond to this therapy. It's available to people ages 8 years or older, again, in stage 2 type 1 diabetes that is confirmed, and they need to have 2 of these type 1 diabetes autoantibodies and dysglycemia confirmed in a variety of ways, either through an oral glucose tolerance test or by fasting glucose or 2-hour postprandial glucose. I encourage everybody to read the label of this drug, and you certainly need to ensure that there is no clinical history of type 2 diabetes.
For patients who are eligible for teplizumab, how do they receive access, or how can they receive access, and how do patients actually receive the treatment?
That's a great question. I'll start with the end of your question, Mel. Teplizumab is infused daily, once daily over a 14-day period, and the infusion is not repeated following the initial 14-day infusion. I would say that if a person is screened through one of the research pathways I mentioned, either TrialNet or ASK, they will be connected to experts in the field who will provide the option for teplizumab. If you're planning to screen in your clinical practice, and if you're in primary care, I think it's essential before you start screening to set up all the other parts of the clinical workflow, again, before that first person walks through the door and receives a screening test. And I really can't emphasize this enough. So you need to be thinking about, how will you conduct confirmatory testing? Are you going to recommend a research pathway? Are you going to do it in your clinic and create a clinical workflow? How will you ensure that people realize the benefits of screening? And so are you going to be able to conduct staging in your clinical workflow? Can you do an oral glucose tolerance test? Or once you confirm somebody, is this the time to refer to specialty care? And then really importantly, do you have a referral partner who can talk to people and engage in shared decision-making about teplizumab and also about options in type 1 diabetes clinical trials once they've been identified with confirmed positive autoantibodies? So these are all important questions. There may be some specialty practices out there listening, and I would strongly recommend that you review a statement from the Pediatric Endocrine Society that outlines the requirements for teplizumab infusion. And this talks about what facilities you'll need. Remember, it's a 14-day infusion, so your infusion center is going to need to be open on the weekends, as well as the pre-infusion assessment of the individual and the baseline labs you're going to draw and the daily labs required during the infusion. So again, I'm hoping we could drop into the chat this Pediatric Endocrine Society statement, which I think will be really helpful to our specialty clinics that are listening out there. Mel?
Absolutely. All those resources will be available to our audience. Let's take a look at other screening results and the patients affected. What about those patients who have confirmatory screening that indicates they are in stage 3 T1D? What are their options other than, obviously, insulin treatments?
So thank you for that question, because stage 3 type 1 diabetes, again, for everybody, that is a classic diagnosis. What we used to think about as the classic diagnosis of type 1 diabetes, hyperglycemia, hyperphagia, especially in kids, so a lot of hunger, frequent urination, thirst, often in adults, blurred vision because we get a lot of glucose that lodges in the lens. These folks, not only should they be introduced, as the guidelines now say, to CGM, continuous glucose monitoring at diagnosis, and in some cases be offered automated insulin delivery at diagnosis, this is also a really important opportunity to introduce research. And we have studies exploring other therapies that can protect those beta cells in the pancreas, the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. We have 5 nationwide studies. We'll get anybody in the U.S. to one of those study sites to participate. They are so important to the future of our field. And we have another 7 to 8 single-site studies, again, testing therapies to protect the insulin-producing cells. We need everybody out there thinking about research for people who are newly diagnosed in stage 3 type 1 diabetes, because that's how we are going to get to further delay of the diagnosis and eventually prevention. We've got some great resources about these studies on our website. I hope you will learn more and feel confident in introducing them to the people you care for so that they can make a decision about research participation. And I just want to add, most of these studies require being not only introduced and enrolled, but randomized by 100 days post-diagnosis. So you've got to introduce them early and not later.
Again, all good information. Protect those beta cells. That's a motto that clinicians...
Beta is better. Mom.
Beta is better. Yes, yes. Any final thoughts on early stage T1D detection and management that you have for not only healthcare professionals, but even patients and caregivers who might be listening?
Yes. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm always excited to say a few more things, but I'll try to keep it short. I think if you're a healthcare professional and you're not currently offering screening to every family member of a person with type 1 diabetes, today is the day to start thinking about your clinical workflow or your referral process and start doing that. That is going to help people realize the benefits of early detection. If this isn't something you think you can operationalize in your clinical workflow, You can consider one of the research pathways, but I'd also encourage you to consider participating in our pilot clinic program where we're helping people set aside some time, clinical practices to set aside some time and work on their own clinical processes as they transition to, again, this new paradigm of care. If you're a family member, I think there's been some hesitancy in the past to participate in screening because the feeling was that you were only going to get bad news. But the truth is, for family members, 95% of the time, you're going to have no detected autoantibodies, and you're probably going to get a result that you're very happy with. So that's something to consider. It's very rare to come back with positive antibodies, but if you do, now there is something, some action that you can take, and we know there are realized benefits. I would just reiterate that you can refer family members or family members yourselves out there. You can participate in the TrialNet program at no cost. And anyone in the United States, ages 1 to 99, who doesn't have a diagnosis of diabetes can be tested through the ASK program. Again, that program will also test you for type 1 and celiac disease. And you can collect that blood at home by pricking your finger, or you can go to a local lab. If you're in primary care and you are providing screening, please think about that confirmatory testing process. How are you going to get that done? Because it's not just one and done with the screening. You've got to do the confirmatory testing, and you need a referral partner for people who confirm positive. If you need help with this, I want to share a resource I haven't talked about yet. It's called the Ask the Experts program. They are out there for people either in primary or specialty care. They're also at the Barbara Davis Center at the University of Colorado. It's led by a physician named Kimber Simmons. And they will help you with all kinds of resources, not just education, but they'll help you co-manage the screening process and the monitoring process for people in your clinical practice, and they can do that remotely.
Anastasia, thank you for your encouraging words, your expertise, all the resources that will help clinicians, patients alike to improve their lives with T1D and to hopefully find a cure soon. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mel. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the importance of screening, early detection, and protecting those beta cells.
We've reached the end of our podcast. I would like to once again thank Anastasia Albanese O'Neill for joining and for sharing her expertise on T1D. Thanks also goes to our supporter, Sanofi US, who provided an educational grant for the CME CE activity. And last but certainly not least, I'd like to thank you, our learning audience, for listening. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. In support of improving patient care, MedLearning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. Please join us for another episode of this podcast series on T1D. For more podcasts and other accredited activities, please visit us online at www.medlearninggroup.com.